Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my trusty co-host and friend, Mr. Spencer Wolfman Williams.
Yeah, I like that one. What's it?
Also with us, speaking of hairy predicament, we got with us intern Amy.
Still an intern, but much less hairy. Wahaha. I don't know how to handle okay. That. That was weird.
Speaking of weird, we have a great show in store as we're going to be talking about the recently dropped film out of Blumhouse, and that is Lee Wannell's Wolfman. So stick around as we dive into that, get into the nitty gritty, and talk about our opinions on it. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in to brand new episodes each and every week.
Working on it.
We are weekly. Shush.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website, filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. We are also on Threads.
And Blue Sky.
And you haven't updated that in a while.
Something, something, something.
What?
Blue Sky.
I just updated it the other day. When was the last time you were on Blue Sky?
Like a week ago.
Yeah,
because I decided a while.
The you first time
updated it in like Spencer, over a year.
When was the last time you before that you were on Blue Sky?
I don't know.
That's what I thought. Check us out over at our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom. I'm going in circles. Also, Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe and listen in. Let us know how we're doing and drop us a line. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
That is right. And we'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. This is going to be, we are on episode, the second episode of 2025. And we are well on our way as we go through this cinematic journey of this year. But no great journey is complete without its snacks. Everybody knows road trips are nothing without the road trip snacks. Every trip through a cinematic journey is incomplete without its soda, its mini pizzas, and its popcorn. And apparently there is a celebration for that too.
Yeah, January 19th is actually National Popcorn Day, and I'm really excited because like literally everybody, so AMC, Regal, and Cinemark are, and I don't know if everybody, but that kind of everybody is mm-hmm. doing either some type of like something or other. I know like if you bring your own, it's a BYOB, bring your own yep. bucket to Cinemark for $5 full of popcorn. It has a limit. It has to be clean and it can only be 400 ounces is the maximum. But I got some buckets. I could use some popcorn. I wonder if it includes the kettle corn. Like, I don't know.
See, terms and conditions may apply.
No, I mean, I read the fine print. That's how I know that it's the 400 ounces.
But you don't know about the kettle corn, though.
I know, but that's still corn in and of itself. It's corn. Sorry.
This is what happens when you give the intern an opportunity to lead a conversation. I literally
for popcorn.
I softballed this thing right up to the bat, and she swung and did nothing but fan air.
Hey,
so
it smells like popcorn, at least.
Before we started going on the air, there was a large conversation about snacks and whatnot. And this has devolved into a PSA, apparently, for the day of. Snacks?
No, so this was the thing. When we were having our conversation beforehand, it was the etiquette. We were talking about, like, not only what is etiquette, but what's even allowed for pop, like, not just popcorn, but for snacks. Because my mom used to, like, sneak in, like, the hamburgers from the Happy Meals in like a bag inside of her purse and then be like, this is what you're getting. We're not getting anything else. Like, this is what you eat. Mm-hmm. And so you always kind of felt kind of sketch when you broke them out inside the movie theater.
I never did. And we're not even talking about like what, when you were a kid, that's what, 50 years ago? When I was, no, maybe about like 5-10 years ago. No, actually a little bit more than that, like 10, but it was about 10 years ago, 10-12 years ago. So we're in Sacramento, so there's a theater down in Elk Grove that I used to frequent a lot more. And luckily, right around the corner from that theater, there was a McDonald's. So I used to have this really nice and somewhat roomy, but it didn't look like it was roomy, type of it was like a motorcycle jacket. Mm-hmm. And I would wear it all the time whenever I'd go out. And so the great thing about that jacket is that inside of the sleeves, I could fit like 7 double cheeseburgers.
Oh, 7?
In each sleeve.
So many.
14 double cheeseburgers. So were you literally just shaking out your arm at people? Be like, here, take a cheeseburger.
Oh, no. Pass it down Well, the ones closer to my hand, I could just like palm them and they would fall out. And then once we started getting closer to, I Assassin's Creed the heck out of this.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
And so I would palm. So first off, we would go and order the hamburgers. It's usually me and two of my best friends. We would go and order the hamburgers. They would have some in their jackets. Theirs wouldn't carry as much as mine. And then I would have the ones all throughout the sleeves. And I'd have my jacket zipped up. And I would very stiffly have my arms like bent into my pockets. Like I look like a Gumby character, like trying to maneuver my hands. And then I would walk in. And I remember one time there was a movie theater attendant who was mopping right in the front area. And I walked in and I guess one of the burgers had slipped out of the cup and it fell right in front of me and right in front of him. And he looked at it and I looked at it.
I would just
and then
walking.
He looked at me and I looked at him and I walked up to the burger. It was like, it's like like one of those standoffs in a Western movie. I walked up to it and he was still looking at me and he had the broom in his hand. And he looked at me walking up to this burger and I leaned down still looking at him and I picked up the burger and I stood up and I walked, I took like 2 steps to him and I extended my arm out and I'm like, and he looked at me, goes, shoot. And he put the burger thing and he walked up. And I'm like, all
it's
right,
good payoff
cool.
Strategy.
Yeah.
It's good.
I'm like, you saw nothing. But I mean, that's how we used to do like McDonald's back in the day when like double cheeseburgers were a lot more cheap. Inexpensive, oh, you know, like we're talking like $1.99 for a double cheeseburger
or less.
Yeah. We would get like a whole bunch of those.
No,
it's see, that's the thing. It's not an old thing. It's an inflation thing. 100%. It has nothing to do with age because
it is
100%. But no, I think the term snacking when it comes to films is it's subjective, I think, personally. Yeah. Like in my idea, like snacking in a theater, like going to a movie and enjoying some food would typically mean like a mini pizza, a large soda, mm-hmm. you know, maybe some candy. Some people, they just like popcorn. Some people just like, you know, some candy. Some people like, you know, just something to drink. I mean, obviously younger me would prefer like double cheeseburgers instead.
Well, then you also have like those places where they have like the full restaurants and the bar and they're
Studio
like
movie grill.
They're like, hello, would you like to order an appetizer, an entree, a dessert, and then maybe an aperitif? And you're like,
yeah, but then that's
you're in the middle of my movie.
But then that's where you start creating that line where like, when does it no longer become snacking? And it ultimately becomes a full on meal. And then is it still a movie theater experience? Are you still going to the movies or are you like, you know, because then are you focused on your meal or are you focused on the movie?
This is a real ship of Theseus. How many parts of the movie
exactly.
theater experience can you replace?
Because in my mind, this is how I see it. As long as you can still eat it with your hands,
and
it should be considered
on the screen?
And be able to still focus on the screen. I think that's a great movie snack.
Okay, wait a minute, because you could fit a lot of things into that umbrella. What if there's like
eat
this insane
cleanly
thing?
With your hands. How about that? We're not talking about, oh, I'm gonna pick up this spaghetti and I'm gonna put it in my face.
I'm talking about like, what if like a movie there is like, it's burrito night.
What, are they chimichangas?
I'm sorry, what do you eat burritos with? What are you one of those high uppity people who have to eat it with a fork and knife?
No,
wait, is it a wet burrito? because then you might want
to
have like
look,
a fork.
If you're going to a movie theater that sells wet burritos, I'd be a lot more worried about what else they sell on the back end, okay?
Sketchy.
But no, like, I mean, a burrito can be handheld. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Chicken strips, handheld. Hot dogs, handheld. Popcorn, you don't do it with a spoon. Everything is handheld.
Now I want to eat popcorn with a spoon just to be divided. I want to see how that's just messed up and weird.
No, that's just you. I think that the element where it starts moving into, oh, and here is your knife and fork, sir. Please enjoy your meal.
Oh, I consider a burrito that can be a full meal.
Yeah, if
the
you're
right kind of burrito.
Yeah, I mean, but when are you getting served a full on like Chondo's burrito or a freaking Adalberto's burrito in a movie theater? Like, I'm thinking if you say burrito and I'm thinking movie theater, I'm thinking like the ones that are in the, you know, microwavable ones, the ones that you get from like.
That's just an insult.
Have you seen the chicken strips at the movie theater? Those are insults.
Those are becoming more insulting.
Also, like, can we talk about Cinemark's offerings, really? Because they are garbage. There was one day where I had, like, been at work and I didn't have time for lunch or whatever. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm hungry and I'm going to a movie after the fact. And I'm like, what is this? There is no true, like, potato option for anything.
Nope.
Right.
Like, not even a hamburger.
But that's hit or miss. Cause like most Regals aren't, they're not that. I mean, they
can be,
some of them have better options, but there are a couple that just totally miss.
They look at you and they're like, I don't think you really want to even touch this either. And you're like, you know what? You're probably right. I don't want to try that.
But yeah, we say all that to say, hey, bring your own bucket, whatever.
Last thing.
Oh.
Since we all talked about sneaking food into the theater.
Yeah.
Ooh, you have a story.
Yes. So I went with a group to see, what was it? The Dark Knight.
Okay.
And so I went with like this husband and wife couple. And so we got
you
to
were third
seats.
Wheeling it?
No, there's other people. I was sitting next to them.
Oh, okay.
And so like as the movie's starting, like the wife turns to me, she's like, do you want a drink? And I'm like, sure. And so she opens up her purse and she gives me a cup and she opens up this 2 liter of soda that she brought with her and just starts pouring it for everybody. And I was like, never have I been more jealous of a purse.
You can totally have that, but I'm also like 2 liter.
Hold on. We're getting into a whole nother level.
That's bringing out the chicken in the tinfoil.
No. Hold on. If you're the type of person, now mind you, I snuck food that is handheld, food that
self-contained.
If you're sneaking whole Tupperware with foil tops or even the plastic tops at that, either way, if you're bringing in whole Tupperware of actual meals that were probably
maybe the next day.
With a 2 liter bottle of soda and plastic cups.
The cups is what gives it. It's the 2 liter.
That's some Boondocks stuff. That's some Boondocks level stuff where like, man, granddad. Like, no, like straight up. That is just complete. You don't. That's a whole nother level.
I was shocked too. I was like, I wish I could just carry a purse for this whole thing.
Out of your entire story, the only thing I could have every day the same level of confidence that woman had to break out a 2 liter bottle in the middle of a movie.
And it's the and cups. Because I've seen teenagers with like, they wear the big jacket and they have the not full 2 liters, or they have the 2 liters that have already been opened. So it won't make the big loud like But even then, they're like, whatever, I'm going to just drink this. And they pass it around. But cups. You got a 2 liter and cups? No, that is some forethought that... That's shocking.
Eye opening.
That's such great confidence. Like, I can't handle that.
Wait, well, she did. She had it. I saw her with that bag the whole time. I was like, oh, okay. She's just got a bag. Okay. Little did I know. I was being schooled.
Was there chicken in it too?
I don't remember.
What is with you and chicken? Is it because he's black that you keep bringing up the chicken? This is the second time you said chicken. Other people bring lasagna or spaghetti or
not
they bring tacos.
MLK weekend.
Or they, like, the heck?
No.
She's over here like,
the reason I ask is because
were y'all gonna go see Soul Plane too?
No, like, no,
was it Friday after next?
No, because
I bet it was a Madea movie.
Let me talk. Because one of the because one of the last times I went to a movie by myself, three chairs down, there were teenagers that brought in fire wings, and they're sitting
That's not fried chicken. No, that's not the same thing.
Because one of them also had two of them had fire wings, and then one had banchan. And then he just looked at me and picked up a chicken leg, Korean fried chicken, and just crunch. And I'm like, what is even going on here?
What is even going on here? I had a better segue a little bit ago until she started bringing in the racist part of it. But it's like,
are you serious? Like,
are you serious? Just drop the chicken thing, man.
Maybe I'm hungry and I just want chicken.
Speaking of hungry,
there we go.
Yeah, there it is.
So that does bring us to our conversation of the evening as we, you know, curb around Amy's racism and move right on to the next.
Are you serious?
You have to be careful. Some AI robot could probably just listen in and be like, yes, chicken is racist.
Yes, there's no stereotype with chicken anywhere, is there?
Oh, God. Huh. I'm just hungry.
Next, she's going to be asking for yard birds too. Watch. You don't know what a yard bird is?
Nope. And I'm not going to learn because
it's a chicken.
I don't know. And we segue with speaking of hungry.
Speaking of hungry. There we go. This is us transitioning over into our main conversation of the evening. And that is our take on the recently released film from Blumhouse. And that is 2025's Wolfman. This movie has been anticipated as another opportunity for Blumhouse to kind of highlight and pay homage to the Universal monsters of old. This is the second from director Leigh Whannell in that whole series, where he did do The Invisible Man in 2021.
Oh, what? I thought that was just before the pandemic.
No, it wasn't.
I was in the apartment.
Yes. Tell everybody about that, Spencer. Why don't you?
2020.
I will not.
Oh, 2020. Okay. This is his second effort in that particular run of films. So we will dive into that, and as well as all of our opinions. But before we do, Spencer, instead of giving out your personal information, why don't you give us that official synopsis?
Oh, wow. I lived in an apartment at one point in time. A seemingly... A seemingly ordinary family man, Blake Lovell, is forced to confront his dark past, where he becomes infected with a werewolf curse, leading him to struggle to protect his wife, daughter, while battling his own monstrous transformation, as he grapples with the growing primal urges from within.
Directed by Leigh Whannell from a screenplay he co-wrote with his partner Corbett Tuck, the film stars Christopher Abbott, Julia Garner, and Sam Yeager. Couple key pieces about the film: Christopher Abbott watched hours of animal videos on YouTube to grasp the wolf's body language. Quote, there's different levels as the process is happening. Excuse me. There's maybe 80% human, 20% animal, and then that shifts. So to track how a human would react to something as opposed to an animal, a human reacts one way if it's ill or if it's scared, as opposed to how does an animal act? How if it feels ill, all its little levels, blah, blah, blah. As he explained. So there's a lot of research apparently on Christopher Abbott's part to actually get that part down, especially when you're looking at a transformation sequence that's been done in film for so many times throughout the course of the last maybe 80, 90 years. Mm-hmm. Everything from the black and white films to the original Universal Monsters Wolfman with Lon Chaney, all the way through to, you know, John Landis's An American Werewolf in London, and thus far since then, like, there's been iterations of it in certain films and whatnot. So getting down the mannerisms is honestly one of those things where it is a very unique take. Not many times do you actually get people who incorporate the animal side of it, I guess, if you want to say, as opposed to just the painful part of transforming. Mm-hmm. So that's actually really interesting that he actually went that way. Another key piece of the information about the film: the moving truck in the film is a fictional company called Pierce, which has been in business since 1941. The name references Jack Pierce, who was Universal's classic monster makeup artist in their 30s and 40s heyday. 1941 references the year Universal's original The Wolfman film was released. So that was a great homage to everything going on there. And in fact, you know, this is one of those particular individuals where I feel had it not been for something like that, they probably wouldn't even be mentioned in these more modern takes. So it's good that they're actually, you know, making that opportunity. So it's really great that they have an opportunity to highlight individuals like this in the industry, because had they not have had that homage, I don't think, like, you have somebody who is so instrumental in those movies back in the day that, you know, you can't just overlook the efforts of somebody like that. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. somebody like Jack Pierce, who was so instrumental in creating what we now know as, like, the kind of the visual iconography, like the significance of each individual creature and whatnot. 100%. Last but not least, Lee Wannell explained that he was inspired by the grotesque transformations of films like The Thing and The Fly, while makeup designer Arjean Tuitin notes that it's the appearance of characters transforming between, quote, two anatomies trying to mix that don't quite go together. And it's a painful one at that, end quote. Wannell explained that one touch point for him and Tuitin was Heath Ledger's iconic version of the Joker from The Dark Knight. Quoted, "That's an iconic character. Chris Nolan's coming into this movie," Wannell said, "there's so many different ways you can go with the Joker, right? As we've seen, I feel like he made a conscious decision to give people a Joker they had not seen before. And it worked. And so that was my thinking going into this was, what do I do? And I felt like you can't compete with Rick Baker and what he did on American Werewolf in London. So what if I took more of a disease approach and approached it more like something like The Fly?" Which is an interesting perspective to have, because when you take the whole transition or the time that it took for the transition of Jeff Goldblum's character in The Fly to actually fully turn into that, versus that one instance of it by the character in An American Werewolf in London. That transformation in An American Werewolf in London happened over the course of like a couple minutes, whereas the transformation in The Fly was the whole film. Like, you were watching this transformation and ultimately like the coming to fruition of that particular character's design to fully flesh out by the end of the film, but it took the whole movie to get there. You know, so the fact that that's where they took inspiration from, I really do have to commend him on that, because that's a very different perspective when it comes to the Wolfman. Not many times do you actually ever think of it as like disease. You think of it more as a curse. You think it more as a like as a monster emerging, so to speak, not as like a debilitating, invasion of, you know, your immune system and things like that, which ultimately, not to kind of give things away, but that is the presentation that this movie does give, you know, right off the bat. So diving in, let's go ahead and talk about this film. And of course, as we stated, this movie is really great and we're really excited to talk about it. But we are going to be discussing few and very minute spoilers. So you are warned. Spoiler alert. Yeah. Yeah. So let's start with expectations. Let's start with Amy in terms of like, what were some of your expectations going into a movie such as this?
Yeah. So I did see Lee Wannell's The Invisible Man. I know he had worked on, I guess, some of the Saw franchise.
Yeah, he wrote for a couple of the films. Him and James Wan were actually writing partners for a time.
Aww. All just trying to scare me. Anyway, I had seen The Invisible Man, which scared the bejeebers out of me. It triggered some things. Oh my gosh, that was amazing. Coming into this, my expectations from what I had continually started seeing, especially from the trailers, was this a little bit Monster Within, a little bit like what do you do when the people that you are supposed to protect.
When they come for you.
Yes. Yes, exactly like that. But really, my expectations were, I was hoping to have some type of really like good psychological ties to the story and the experience in and of itself. And I was hoping not to be as scared as much as I was in The Invisible Man, because, oh, that was just scary and scary. So yeah, I will save my
scary and scary, Spencer.
It was scary and scary. So yeah, I'll say that. Spencer, what about you for expectations?
Okay, so I didn't know.
And try to top scary but scary.
And it was an and, not a but.
Yeah, scary and scary.
Scary and scary. Sorry.
Okay, so like this one was one of the movies where I didn't look anything up about the background, like who's directing. I didn't know. I was like, I saw the trailer and I'm like, I'm in. I'm ready to go on this movie, because I was like, this seems like it's going to be a great story. So I'm like, you know, I'm sure I'll learn about everyone I'm going to love in the next 2 hours. That's really what I came into this movie with. What about you, Ed?
The biggest thing, and this is something that Amy reminds me of, is that, you know, in terms of expectations, like, I guess I had high expectations to a certain extent, mainly because of the fact, part of the reason is that I have the original Lon Chaney Wolfman tattooed on my arm.
He's staring at us now.
So I do have an affinity to those classic Universal monster movies. They're some of my favorite types of films. And I think the biggest thing for me was knowing that the director who did this one was the same director who did The Invisible Man, and as cerebral and interesting as The Invisible Man was, I was hoping that this movie takes as much of as deep a dive into whatever message it's trying to get across, as well as not losing the overall goal of the film and the franchise it's trying to further and pay homage to, and just give us something that really is that beautiful kind of medley of the two, you know. But as far as just like bare expectations, I think that's pretty much it. Like, obviously this movie had to be cohesive. It had to, you know, mirror exactly the source material it's coming from. And then on top of that, still give us a decent, you know, a decent deep thread to it, I guess. I don't know. Like, it's what you would come to expect out of these ones. Like, when it comes to Blumhouse, they're always hit or miss. Like, obviously, they are the same people who did the first Invisible Man movie as of late. Well, what do we say? 2021?
2020.
Or 2020.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're also the ones who do movies like Truth or Dare or Fantasy Island or like Hide. They've done a bunch of like interesting and maybe just kind of they felt like a what are they called? Just seat filler movies. Just, you know, kind of like, wait, what? Why is there a movie about this? Why are we, you know, it's one of those studios that doesn't always hit the mark every time when it sends something to the theaters.
You know what's interesting about that is I kind of like it. It's like low-key gambling. Like, is this about to be a knockout of the park or a waste of your time?
But that's the problem, though. Like, if it's like a random premise of like, oh, you know, what did I say? Like, oh, the Fantasy Island. Like, oh, Fantasy Island. I didn't really see that TV show because I wasn't around for that. But, yeah, you know.
That was a weird premise. They should have thought about that.
I don't think they did.
But that's also like, if you have the money and the luxury to be able to be like, oh, they got me excited for this film, I'm going to go see it. You want your money well spent. Like, and that really comes down to the question of, but it is, it's like, roll the dice. If I've got two credits, I might as well see them. Like,
that seems like it would be a waste of a credit if it's a movie that's really bad.
And you can always be like, I'd like my credit back, please.
No, you can't do that after. That's like going to a restaurant, getting a meal, eating the whole meal and saying, I didn't really like it. Can I get my money back? That doesn't work that way. I don't care how much
have you
like,
done that before?
Right? Oh my gosh.
I know people that have, but I have not.
Well, it looked like you've done it before.
No.
So it's like,
unfortunately, I am not that ridiculous.
I don't know. Past episodes would prove otherwise. So I assumed, like, obviously, again, when it comes to gambling, yes, if it's a franchise, like something where they're doing the Fantasy Island storyline or whatever, that's fine. But if you're using a franchise or a story element that's something near and dear to people's hearts, like, say, The Invisible Man or The Wolfman, or even, like, if they do a Frankenstein movie, because I don't know if Guillermo del Toro's movie is under Blumhouse's banner.
That's a good point.
Or even a Dracula movie that's more Bela Lugosi-esque, because I don't think Nosferatu's A24.
Yeah.
So, again, when you're going along the lines of, like, a franchise like that, that becomes a little bit more dicier. And the need for that to hit the mark is a lot more important, especially for fans of the franchise. So,
100%.
But moving to first impressions. So we went to the movie theaters. We got a chance to see the film. And I want to know, Spencer, what was your first impression right outside the gate?
There's a lot to like in this movie, but then also a lot to be like, what's going on here? Why is this movie structured in this way? But, like,
you're pulling out all the stops on this whole, like, high-end, like, snacks or no snacks? Like, I'm half hoping that you're going to pull out, like, a bubble pipe.
And a monocle.
And a monocle and a top hat somewhere. Come in like one of those, what are those robes that they wear?
I used to have a bubble pipe as a child that blew bubbles.
I believe it. I believe it. Go ahead, continue.
No, that's about it. I don't want to get into the spoilers, Eddie. The spoilers. Amy, what about you?
There we go.
First impressions right at the gate. This movie was trying to say a lot and sometimes executed sporadically in places. And sometimes hit the mark, sometimes didn't. And it has things that really kind of need to be delved into to continue a conversation.
I think that's pretty, it's a pretty succinct way to say it. Because
good job.
I did it.
I agree. Like, this movie made efforts to, so first off, I can say that this movie did not land flat entirely. It did stick the landing in certain areas and it did, you know, have a little bit more trouble landing the plane in others. But all in all, I felt like this was a you know, a good effort of a film. We'll get into the nitty gritty of it shortly, but all in all, I do have to agree. I feel like there were certain things that were conveyed a little bit more transparently, and there were a couple of other elements that were a little more heavy-handed, some that were a little too light-handed, and but let's dive in. So talking about the performers right out the gate, let's talk about the actors. So we have Christopher Abbott, who played Blake Lovell. The dad, and then we had
Julia Garner.
That's right. I'm trying to find her in the.
She's the mom.
Yeah, and then we had
Matilda
Firth, who played the daughter Ginger. And I got something stuck in my throat. And so these are the three people you pretty much see the entire time throughout this whole movie. Mm-hmm. Every now and then you'll have, like, you have one person who showed up towards the beginning of the film, but that was it. He was gone.
Technically two.
Was there two?
There was the flashback sequence.
Oh no. Oh yeah. So the dad does show up.
The dad's dad.
But so the primary three people that we have is Christopher Abbott, Julia Garner, and Matilda Firth. Mm-hmm.
That's it. if we're going to talk about performances, I think the just right out the gate, we need to kind of talk about the person that seems to carry most of the film, which is Christopher Abbott as Blake, the dad. Performance wise, he actually does have not only the biggest arc that we see, but also moves through it fairly effortlessly and believably. Mm-hmm. He's well written, and it's conveyed it is conveyed in such a way that it actually feels like organic growth and organic change, even though the monstrous transformation is literally happening overnight. And then even when we see the backstory for him as a child, which that kid did a solid job too, mm-hmm. I don't even know if he's credited, poor kid, but...
The little boy?
Yeah, the little boy.
Yeah, Zach Chandler. He's in there.
Yay, good job, Zach. But yeah, Christopher, I think really at the brass tacks of it is like the one that is motoring this boat forward at a very even keel, at a very even pace. And I really appreciated him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he did a phenomenal job. Just his overall, like, from the beginning of, like, starting with the adult version of him, like, just, like, you know, him dealing with, like, his, like, own personality and the thing that's from his father that he doesn't like about himself that you can tell that he's trying not to, like, you know, deal with his daughter with. He does a good job of just, like, creating a lot of context for the character and, like, understanding, like, you know, where he is from and what he's trying to do. And then the movie, like, as it, like, drags him along this descent into madness, he does a good job of, like, portraying the madness of, like, I don't know what's happening. Why is this happening? And before we stop hearing from him.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I think the biggest trait that we see, you know, translated across the screen is the sentiment of obviously being with Christopher Abbott, someone who's being fathered by somebody overbearing and trying not to be like his dad. Like we get that sentiment throughout this entire film, but we also see it translated physically in a lot of the acting and the performances that he does physically as well as emotionally with his family and the care that he has even in during the course of the transformation and whatnot. Obviously, you know, it's no spoiler, you know, he it's in the trailer. He is ultimately bitten or infected and is changing. Mm-hmm. But through the course of his transformation in the film, we do see him translate a lot of that care and concern he has for his family, even in the midst of being feral at times. So
yeah. And then if you put in juxtaposition, Julia, is it Gardner or
Garner?
Garner. This is where I struggled, and I can't tell if this is the writing or just her delivery. That it is really difficult in juxtaposition to Chris or to Christopher, who is like, he's all in and he says so much without having to say so much, and not just physicality, but in expression and emotion. Like, and we get Julia, who looks shell-shocked the entire, who's standing there like she is dumbstruck, and that is the correct term of it, dumbstruck, deer in the headlights, almost the entire time. And then there are sputtering moments in her character where I don't believe the progression. Mm. Perfect example is when we see them at the beginning, they're having difficulty in their marriage.
Yeah.
And Chris has proposed, Blake in the movie has proposed that they all go up to, you know, he just found out his dad's been legally declared dead. He's got to go move the things out of the house. He's like, everybody come with me. And she's like, okay. And you can tell, like, they've been hecka out for a long time. And then literally, like, maybe a couple hours later, she's like, I loved you. I've always loved you. You're my best friend. And I'm like, girl, literally like 5 minutes before this, you were like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? What am I supposed to do? And we're just like, I can't tell where the unevenness in that character is, if it's her as an actor or if it's just the writing and she just is interpreting.
I think it might be a little of both, because honestly, she's acting like she's in a different movie. 100%. Like, she's like, wherever she's coming from, it's not a horror movie. She's an investigative journalist, and like her husband is like, well, you need to be here.
She's just a journalist.
No, I know she's just a journalist in this movie, but where she's from.
Oh, gotcha.
Like, she's like in her world and she's like doing things with like journalism. But like, yeah, there's like a weird starting and stop where she is just awkward around him. Like, if I had watched this movie, like, just saw the beginning, I'd be like, oh, they're getting divorced. Because, yeah, like, that seems where we're going. But like,
it's already established that that's what's happening.
Yeah, but like, from his perspective, it kind of seems like, oh, no, this marriage is just kind of going downhill for some reason. We need a course correct. Yeah. So it's like they're in different spots.
Yeah.
And not agreeing on, like, what is happening with this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's really weird.
I think so. And the biggest kind of, I guess, telltale sign of this, that it unfortunately is more on her than on him, is that as a family person, the dad is like right on the money. Yeah. Like he is absolutely, you can tell, you know, that he is the dad. He loves his daughter. But when it comes to the wife slash mom, she just feels like they were a regular family. And then like the mom had to step out and someone else had to play the role. And they inserted this woman into it.
Or it's like she's the girlfriend, but hasn't figured out how to be like a part of their family yet.
Oh,
like,
that would almost make
like,
it better.
See, because my brain, in the way that that was playing, like she's so wrapped up in her job and he's got like, he's in parent mode, but he carries all of those patterns of like, this is my kid, I love, and this is my family. And she's got that like, I'm a businesswoman and I come home and we're dating, but we're not together. Like we're together, but we're not together yet. And you can't find kind of like that mesh. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's uncomfortable is the polite way
just,
to say it.
It just doesn't seem realistic. Like it's not translated well on screen.
Also, like the script does her no favors. Going back to that line where she said like, oh, you're my best friend. I'm like, where is this coming from?
Right?
Because like, I was like, this seems like a trauma bonding experience type thing happened where she just feels closer to him because they're both going through something super horrible at this time. Maybe that's what they're going for, but I also am not sure.
Yeah. Which I mean, to the credit of the director, knowing what he's done with what we've seen in The Invisible Man, mm-hmm. that might be the case where it's like in the situation that they're in, like maybe appeasing whatever is going on with him is probably the best way for them to kind of, in her mind, like course correct this so that way he gets better. He finds a reason to keep fighting to live maybe or get better, you know. But unfortunately, I know that Julia Garner's had a couple of other films in her filmography and she's done other things that probably are great and she's done well.
Well, isn't she also supposed to be the Silver Surfer?
What?
For
what?
I will do the looking because my brain.
Oh yes, you're right.
Oh,
I did not know
she's
this.
A Silver Surfer.
Yeah, she's Fantastic coming up in first steps.
Yeah, look really? At that.
Yeah,
ta ta ta. Pull that one out.
All
of
right,
there.
So we're gonna be seeing her a few Snatch. Months again.
She's gonna be wearing a lot of silver.
We're talking about Julia Garner.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I pulled it up on her IMDb, so she's okay. gonna be in first steps.
There we go.
Oh, okay, sure. But that does bring us obviously to the daughter as well.
Matilda Firth.
Matilda Firth, who plays Ginger. I'd say she did a great job. She played a kid. I mean, she is a kid essentially. She played one of those types of children who has to be the adult at times, or at least take charge of certain situations. And this was one of those types of movies where the child is very much a product of the parenting. Mm. And especially in this case where the dad is very passive because he doesn't want to be overbearing like his father. I mean, she was a kid. She played kid well. I don't know if there's really a lot of, there's not a lot to really go off of in terms of like, there was no dramatic or precise moments throughout the movie that really highlighted her ability to be what I'm pretty sure she probably is like outside of the film.
Yeah. And I think the other thing for Matilda, again, like you said, she's a kid. The relationship she has with her dad, Blake, is very like, it's not, you can't just say it's amicable. You can actually see there's genuine kind of like affection. Like the chemistry there as father and daughter is perfectly balanced. Like she still gives him a hard time. And he is still, as you said, he's trying to be passive about how he raises her and how he works with her. But she knows where the line is towed and where it's not. And then as things progress in the movie, you suddenly kind of see her trying to, because of her dad forcing her to, kind of like pushing her away, that she's trying to lead into her mom. And you can kind of see where it's, again, that relationship doesn't feel natural at all. And so that's where I was like, she could just have been the girlfriend. Like, that would make sense.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the story elements that, that would have probably change the way you saw her as the wife, but it probably would have changed the dynamic of, like, to the credit of the story. I think if they would have made the character divorced, it probably would have been more indicative that he's more apt to being like his dad, because we don't really know what happened to the mom.
Yeah, 100%.
Earlier on in the beginning of the movie, when the dad's a younger form of himself as a kid, it's just him and his dad living at the house and so forth. And so that's how the dynamic is explained. They don't really explain, like, where the mom is, if the mom passed away, or, you know, if the mom maybe left and then she passed away, things like that. Nothing's explained. So
no, there's a lot of inference, but it kind of traps you. And again, that builds again more of Blake's story than it does anybody else's, which seems to be like that over. The entire thing is Blake's story. Like, if we want to start delving into story, unless there's somebody else we want to talk about.
No, let's go ahead.
Because it's not really.
There's no one else.
There's nobody else. Much
for the cast.
Yeah, no.
There's go ahead. The wilderness. I think really the story in and of itself from start to finish is Blake's story, as much as there's like the interjection of like transformation and change. As soon as we have that flashback, you know, we have the opening titles about there's a hiker that went missing and people have seen him running around, but no one's found him. And the native people call it like face of a wolf or something like that. And we see little Blake getting like out of bed. His father literally yells Ten Hut, and immediately he's rolled out of bed. He's straightening everything. And then there is such a tight dress, right dress about how he's supposed to do it. You know that's the person at the core of the story, is that little kid that hasn't been able to ever get out of that shadow. But it's he again. That's where it's like, I don't know if it had been just him and his daughter, or it was necessary to have a mom in the picture for this, or a female counterpart. I don't know what
I. The thing is this is the issue that this movie has, is that if it were just the dad and the daughter, it may have added more of the parallel and maybe might have struck a bit more to the heart of the comparison to when he was younger. But at the same time, then it ultimately turns into like a Home Alone-esque type of vibe, because now you have this helpless child who now has to run away and hide from her dad, who is turning slowly.
That's gonna be rough.
That's a really rough one.
This is gonna be like the saddest version of Home Alone.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no versus cans.
Versus if you did, again, if you did the, you know, dating version where the dad and it's the dad and the daughter, and the dad's dating this woman. I think it would have, first off, lent itself to the Blake, right? Blake is the name of the dad?
Yeah.
Blake's character kind of already falling into some of the pitfalls and the bad habits, if you will, of his father, and whatever the reason why there's no mom. And then it would have started the kind of shifting you as the viewer, the mindset to, oh, well, he must be just like his dad, which is kind of part of the story, I guess, traversing, like the journey that you get into, like, oh, he's, you know, fighting that, which, you know, he's been, you know, mentally struggling with for all this time, fighting against that, which he does not want to become. It's difficult because the character itself is not a bad character. It's just poorly executed, unfortunately. And that's not to say that not Jennifer Garner. What is her name?
Julia Garner.
That's not to say that Julia Garner is a bad actress. That's to say that the direction and execution for that role probably isn't the best. Because if you had taken that particular same role and you had put somebody who is a lot more aware or adept of like the situation, even maybe having stemming a lot of their, you know, inspiration on like personal, you know, experience or even previous roles, maybe a much more nuanced actress may have given, you know, or actor, you know, however, you know, could have given the dynamic of the relationship a little bit more, I guess, weight, gravitas, more believability. But unfortunately, you know, and again, it's not to say that Julia Garner is a bad actress. That is to say that the way she was directed to execute it probably was not the best choice. So, but overall, the story is about Blake, you know, ultimately finding out that his father's been declared dead and that he needs to go to the old cabin to which he had left.
It's 30 years. It's a farmhouse. It ain't even a cabin. That thing is massive.
To the property and go and help clean up so that way, you know, they can make way for whatever else is going to happen next. They don't really talk about what's going to happen to the farmhouse, but he needs to go and clean it up, more than likely to get it ready to be sold. So they all decide to travel together to go out that way to the house. And through mishaps and craziness that happens on the way up there, they ultimately end up getting chased by some entity that, you know, traps them in within the home, and they now have to figure out a way to survive and escape without getting, you know, gnarled to death by whatever creature is banging on the door outside.
And mind you, this is all taking place, the time frame, which I have to say did help the story immensely. This doesn't take place over a week. This is literally like the beginning where he finds out his dad's officially dead. It seems like it's almost like maybe two, three days.
Yeah.
And then boom, they're on their way. And then it's literally happening in the span of one night. Mm. Not only did that, I feel, add to the tension and the weight, like the stakes, but it made it feel like it gave you a little bit more of that claustrophobic kind of feeling that you have when you're looking for a house, like a trapped in the house, cabin in the woods type of vibe.
Which, to the benefit of Lee Wannell and his partner, Corbin Tuck, they actually wrote the first screenplay of this, the first draft of it, during the pandemic.
So in other words, everyone's going crazy. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
So,
yeah, I think it added to the weight of that, where it helped to create the tension that was necessary, that could, that was being lost in the writing and the direction for Julia Garner as a character. Like, there's something to be said about in a story where your partner is literally transforming in front of you, and all you can do is stand there and stare, which we do see people that do that. The flight or fight in people sometimes just leaves them in utter shock. But there was a point where after a couple of hours, you were expecting her to start stepping up, and she wasn't. Like, we got deeper and deeper into the night as things were moving with the story, and there was no, like, even an understanding of, okay, it's time to do things. Like, when we started seeing that shift to action, it felt like it was the hard-hitting journalist that she's been striving to be completely got lost in the sauce. Like, she didn't know what she was doing. There was no survival instinct until literally, like, everything has hit the fan and we have to make decisions now. Like, it begs the question of, was that the writing or the direction to be like, listen, you care, but you don't care enough right now. So just don't do anything. Just stay there. Like, I don't know.
No, it's a great question. It honestly is one of those types of things where, as far as character development, there's not really a lot going into the overall arc of this character. Like, there's really nothing that says consistency or character growth from the beginning of the film to the end of the film, because everything that this character does seems like it's one step removed. Like it's there's a disconnect, so to speak. If we were to put it on a scale from how the father acted, or you know, whatever performer you feel is like the closest thing that has done, like for instance, Denzel Washington in Man on Fire, with Dakota Fanning, like his closeness is tied to that, to Dakota Fanning's character. From that, like being the most invested and tied to the character, to what is her name? Was it Dakota Fanning? That's not Dakota Fanning.
What?
The one from Man on Fire?
Thought it was Dakota.
So what's the name?
Is it not Elle?
No. You're right. To what's her face from Madam Web?
Dakota Johnson.
Dakota Johnson.
It's a Dakota.
To Dakota Johnson. Hey. To Dakota Johnson and her, like, her consideration and care for that man that she was doing CPR on. You know, she's not the character that that this woman has, Julia Garner, isn't so much towards, like, it isn't Dakota Johnson level, but it's there. In that arena. You know, to where, mind you, she does make efforts to look like she cares, but it's not that bad. Spencer looks like he's...
I just feel like that's so mean.
No, but I'm saying on a scale, if we were like putting...
From Denzel to Dakota,
where would you say, Spencer, she falls in that line?
I'm feeling like a 4, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, so yeah...
She's still not out of 100.
Got it.
Out of 100.
No,
I mean,
but
it is Denzel. Like,
going back to the story, as we did say, like the story does. Excuse me. Whew, a lot of burps. The story does lend itself to rebuilding the lore and mythos of the Wolfman origin in this particular film, where.
But it doesn't do anything supernatural. Like, that was the other thing. This seemed to be more focused on disease versus the supernatural of when you're bit. Oh, I almost did a German. I'm not going to do it. Not going to do that accent. I'm redacting. It doesn't have, like, silver bullets. It doesn't have anything that we traditionally, when we're thinking of, like, silver bullet, you know, you turn back. It seems like it has a permanence of disease, and that's the only way moving forward as a quote unquote wolfman, not wolfman. And I don't know how I like that.
No, I agree. I think the biggest thing for this film is, I think, creating the level of almost realism, if you will, to a sense of like the how many steps removed from the sense of reality we are tied to this. I think it gives it a different space, because then now the true monster that we see in like an American Werewolf in London, or Wolfman, or the Wolfman from like 2010, like those types of monsters now seem to be a lot closer to what can actually happen in reality, because we have the potential for that to happen to us based on disease or whatnot.
Which, I mean, if we're following the Invisible Man, which was that crazy suit, which was so great, there was that sense of not only realism, but the likelihood of it happening, which I can see if you're trying to translate that to Wolfman. But again, we're talking about universal monsters and not only the presence of them, but there's something that is so uncontrollable about supernatural that there's no way that we can rationalize it either. Like,
well, but then that also still lends to the idea that like this can be rationalized, because according to the film, this is a situation that has been happening for many decades, as like people are, you know, finding themselves becoming, you know, these entities or being overwhelmed by this feral disease, if you will, to becoming
of a wolf.
Yeah. Some. Why do you keep saying like that?
Because it's so weird. If that's my whole thing, I would. It's like, are you a wolf man? But like, are you a man bat?
But you're also missing
not a man bat.
I get scratched by a man bat. Do I become a man bat? This one is, if I get scratched by a face of a wolf, I become,
which is still part of the original,
of a wolf.
Which is still the part of the original lore. That's what happens to Lon Chaney's character in The Wolfman.
No, I know he gets scratched, but he's not called the face of a
bit,
wolf.
Essentially,
he's called a wolf man.
But it was only the indigenous people who were saying that. None of
but
the
they
actual
never called him a wolf man.
But you're missing the point of it. It's like, it's creating lore within, first off, based in the regional reality of where we are. And then secondly, the fact that the cryptid, I guess, just aspect of the world where there are creatures and whatnot that still have yet to be identified, or things that yet to be explained within the natural formations of the world and the deep rooted forests that are all throughout this entire, you know, this planet. This is digging more into that history, like how there's a Wendigo in certain mm-hmm. stories, or there are skinwalkers through other, you know, as part of the lore of other people, you know, or whatever, you know, types of entities, you know, chupacabras for Latinos and things like that. There's always something based in lore that helps create that connectivity, not only to a group of people, but also to the sense of realism, to explain the things that go bump in the night. And it may not actually be in reality those things, but those are what we end up associating it with. And so, like, in the essence of this, where it's based on like some kind of feral infection or disease that they get and then they become feral, that's not too far off from like what rabies does to animals. Gotcha. So how could this not be in the realm of possibility if there is something that creates a sense of, you know, feral nature within humanity, within humans? So, I mean, we've gotten a sense of that with the most recent season of The Last of Us. So, you know, where a mushroom or a spore is what's taking over people and causing them to become like zombies. So, and the way they presented it was in a very realistic and almost truthful manner.
True.
That made everybody start questioning like the mushrooms that were growing outside their house. But I think that's the nature of this movie, is that it creates the connective nature of what is something that could hit home as easily as catching a cold or getting an infected cut that everybody has had at least once in their life, that could create the concern where if you get this cut or you get this cold, we may never see the real you again.
That's sad.
Yeah, this movie, like, the whole theme of it is deeply depressing.
which that's a whole other story in itself, like the theme of this movie. Without going into full detail, we won't give away most of it, but there is a sense of the fact of, like, when you watch this, if you're a parent or if you're someone who has had a difficult upbringing, and I don't mean difficult like you were abused or anything, but just a difficult upbringing with family members or close friends or things of that sort, where you have ever uttered those words to yourself that when I grow up, I'm going to be different, this movie will affect you. Like, plain and simple. I guess that's just the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Because it is very, like, plain as a nose on your face, kind of obvious when they do get to the main heart of the message.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the journey to it does have some wholesome moments, and it does carry a little bit of heavy-handedness when it does it. But still, like, you can tell, like, the Wolfman aspect of the film was more of it's more of the backdrop versus the real monster that we see come to fruition in this film.
Yeah.
Which you have to hand it to him. Like, obviously the risk, if you will, of bringing a story like that through the lens or through the filter of a very classic horror icon in, you know, the Wolfman or werewolves or things of that sort. Bringing this element into it and making it like the vehicle for this story, it was a risk. It definitely was one that I guess Lee Wannell and Corbin Tuck really thought that it would really land home. And when you're dealing with monsters of that sort, the only kind of, I guess, monster that really fits that bill would be, you know, the Wolfman. So, you know, kudos for the risk taking. I got to give him that.
Yeah, 100%.
Let's talk about some of our highlights or issues. Did you guys have any highlights or issues throughout this movie?
Ooh, yeah.
Let's talk about sound design.
Yeah. Spencer and I are the same over this.
This is a really interesting movie because, like, once you're done with it, you're like, man, why don't other movies use all the speakers in the theater? Because it feels like no one does quite like this. Because, like, there are certain scenes in this movie where, like, someone is being hunted, but, like, the sounds are not just coming from, like, left, right, but also behind.
Above.
And, like, sometimes, like, it'll be, like, the swirling effect of all around you. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, guys, why has no one ever done this before? Like, this is, like, I feel like we should be getting an award for sound design in this movie. Because, like, I was actually pretty impressed just, like, on, like, the sound alone. Like, compare that to, like, The Hitman's Bodyguard, which me and Eddie saw once, and it was just blaring at us.
God, awful.
Sound design of that movie was, like, one of the worst.
It's so loud. No, I 100% agree. This feels so immersive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even we sat through the credits just to listen, and it was, like, it felt like it was traveling over our heads and around behind us. And it felt like each component was literally trying to draw, like, make sure you were inside of the world with these characters. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, that, if the story had been able to just tighten it up and, like, go straight at it, oh, not this, whoa. Yeah. Sir, whoa. But this, yeah, sound design, 100%. I think that was one of my favorite things. I was like, yes.
And the sad thing about it is that, to your point, Spencer, mm-hmm. there are other movies that do it, but not to this degree.
Like, not they this well.
Yeah. To create, because obviously when you're looking at something like The Wolfman, whose senses are heightened and whose hearing is, like, exponentially better and sight and whatnot, like, you are given, like, front row access to that when they do that with the sounds coming from behind or even the sounds of, like that one scene where he's hearing, like, this loud thumping noise and it's a spider just crawling on the wall, but the sound, how it echoes around you in the theater, it was done really, really well. Mm-hmm. Like, that was something that really was impressive.
Yeah. It's like the standout thing for this movie is the sound design. It was so good.
Yeah. I think another favorite for me was, it's right before he starts figuring out he's transforming. You see the tick in Christopher Abbott's performance where he can smell something and he starts shifting his head just enough of a tick, almost like he's a dog that's picked up on something. And then he's listening and he's like, they're stuck in the house. There's something outside. They don't know what it is, but he's moving through each of the rooms. And simultaneously, you see where he's fallen into the routine of the survivalist because this is the house. So you can see him fall back into that. But because you know the transformation's happening and he doesn't, you can watch where he's, like, sniffing the air almost like a hound dog. Mm. And it's such a like minute change. But because you know he's having heightened senses, you're like, oh, that makes sense. But the physicality of it and even, like, the tick and the way he's moving and how he's looking, it's literally like a hunting dog knows that there's something out there and it's tracking it. Like, that was one of my other favorite parts. I was like, wow, this is like, this dude has it. Like, oh my gosh. Okay. That's yeah. Cool.
Well, and then going back to the sound design, like, how they were, one of the other elements that I thought was really great was, you know, the way they would flip the sound where when he started transforming more, he was having a difficult time hearing what other people were saying, and his ability to see certain types of wavelengths of light where the darker areas were more visible and he was seeing, like, the bright parts in their eyes and whatnot. Like, the more and more he kept transforming, how that intensified in, like, just it was a very unique way of highlighting that transformation and ultimately becoming something not like who he used to be. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that shifting into, like, the werewolf part for the, like, the audience to, like, see what he was seeing, I was like, oh, this is fantastic, because, like, can't really think of too many other times where, like, you get to see all of, like, what this person is experiencing, like, during this transformation like this.
Yeah,
especially in some parts where, like, since he's lost the ability to communicate with everyone, like, how alone he feels.
Yeah,
like, that's really heartbreaking.
That was probably the one of the harder scenes to watch, like, seeing where his daughter is genuinely like just telling him how much she cares and that she's here for him. And it's a very heartfelt scene. And then when it does that pivot where it turns on the perspective and it goes to his, and it's just literally like garbledygook, he can't understand a thing. It's like, yeah, he's definitely alone.
Yeah. And then also even when he's talking and he's in like, we're in that mode where we can see how he's seeing and he's like, what's going on? I can't understand you. And then they pivot back to the outside and you see that his mouth is moving and he's like, this, like there's next to no sound. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like he is actively trying to communicate inside of where he's trapped and it can't get out. And it just, it was so, oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I do have to say one of my minor
foibles.
Issues, I guess, with the film. Foibles.
I like the word foibles. It's fun to say.
One of my minor issues of the film was there were a few scenes where it did feel like it may have been just a tad too dark. Where certain elements, like when they're hiding in certain places or whatnot, like there were scenes where the brightness was there and you could see like the more hidden parts that the film wants you to see. Mm-hmm. And then there's certain scenes where it's just like there's something happening, but the screen is ultimately like really black, mm-hmm. really dark. And it made it a little difficult to focus on like, okay, what exactly is happening? Do you want me to focus on the sound or am I watching like these people trying to hide and not be seen or whatever? It just like certain scenes did make it a little difficult to see. Although I was having this conversation with my mom. She was asking me like, what are you guys going to be recording next? And I mentioned her, you know, we're watching, you know, Wolfman. And she goes, oh, you know, what'd you think? And I told her, you know, about my issue with the dark, you know, the dark scenes. And she goes, well, that's the way they used to be back in the day, so I'll be fine with it. And I'm like, okay, so it's just me. I'm the big baby here in this one. But I do feel like some of those scenes could have been a little brighter, just a touch, just so that you could actually see what fully was going on in that.
But I can't tell if they're trying to simulate because they're in the woods. And like yeah. The only light sources are like a few lamps that are on the outside. So it would be pretty pitch dark.
Yeah,
depending on like moon state.
But yeah, moon state is the bigger thing.
Yeah.
If there's moon, you can see everything, but it depends again on cover. But yeah, I mean, there is the sequence, I know what you're talking about, where it's literally like it's pitch black except for like the little bit of light that's trickling in through the windows and you're like, I think I can see something.
Oh no, like during that scene I was like, oh, it's right there.
Yeah.
And then when it pivoted, I was like, I knew it. Girl, you're gonna die.
My gosh.
I think one of the things, if I can give this more accolades, because I've already kind of said like the part of the issue that I had really was especially that mom character. That was the hardest sticking point for me where I had difficulties. But the simultaneous expanse and contraction of the set in and of itself. We have all of the woods everywhere to run and simultaneously nowhere to run. You have like the barn, the house, the truck that don't work, maybe question mark, the greenhouse question mark, the basement. Like it feels so big and so small all together. And then even when they're like running straight out into the open, I'm like, y'all better run faster. It was so weird and so kind of fun and odd for me, especially because, again, I'm still new to horror films, thriller films, whatever you want to call it. Seeing the expanse, but there's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. Like, we're trapped either way. And I was like, oh, I don't like that. I'm not to the point that I'm like, I'm scared of woods being trapped in the woods movies. I really don't like house horror and I do not like body horror. I'm saying it now. This movie, I'm going to gripe about it, but it was a good, I guess it must be good. The body horror in this thing. Oh, So I don't know if that's a plus or a no, but
it's a plus because
but no.
Physical transformation was fantastic. Because like he was just like having nails pop out of places, and then like especially the part where like he just started gnawing on his arm. I was like, leg. Oh my gosh.
And going amazing. Back to the sound design, the way those sounds came across when he was doing those things, like it was just.
And then the random teeth just popping out of your face. I was like, no, sir. No, thank you.
Like, I couldn't take my eyes off the screen, but I'm like cowering in my seat. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Spencer's over here clutching his pearls.
I was like, this is amazing. I'll keep going.
I literally, as soon as he started chomping, I was like, no, thank you, sir. I don't want to see this.
So wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
All right. So this does have a beginning, middle, and an end, even though the ending and there's some foible. I see foibles. I like the word. Oh my gosh.
Heard that word.
There are some hiccups and some stall and start and stop points in the middle that I would have liked to see better fleshed out. So it does pass. As a whole, this is not the follow-up film I thought that would be coming out of Lee Whannell, because The Invisible Man was so good and it left such a strong impression that I've recommended it to people. I can really see but in all of that, I can really see the heart that was there. I can see the messages that we're trying to get across. And while it does stumble, it does stick the landing in certain areas while it misses the runway in others. So for me, this is actually going to get a 2.3 out of 5 monocles. This is not a demand to do better. I'm just hopeful at whatever the next excursion is into the dark universe, as Universal has started calling, you know,
everything. I don't know if they're going to be.
I don't, but.
No, we're very clearly staying away from the dark universe.
100%.
Not getting Tom Cruise back in here.
Well, there's a reason he left as abruptly as he did. But hopefully I'd love to see something else from Lee that maybe takes a different direction and leaves me simultaneously shell-shocked and enthralled.
Spencer.
Okay. Man, this is one of the harder ones to score. This movie does pass, but yeah, like this is a combination of it really stuck the landing in certain things, but then kind of missed in like a lot of other things story-wise. Especially that mom character, like honestly, like let's redo the movie. Redo it mostly, just change a lot of her, and let's see how it lands, because that could really affect how we feel about the movie. But yeah, this is still like it's. There's lots of good things in here. It's just that it's kind of annoying that like they didn't quite hit it on some of the story stuff, because yes, while I avoided the Invisible Man for other reasons and I was like rolling my eyes at it, but it was still like undeniably a good story.
Yeah.
This one doesn't quite live up to that, and it makes me a little sad, I suppose, right? Because like I feel like it's, there's enough pieces in here that it should rise to the occasion of being, if not as good, just only slightly less good.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, I'm going to say 3.5, only because like I was very impressed with like a lot of sound design, practical effects, and like just regular effects in this movie. Like they really kind of impress me and make me want to say everyone else needs to step up.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I have to agree with everything that's been stated. It does pass for me. The film does have a complete story, beginning, middle, and end. It definitely creates the draw in for recognizing the story that's unfolding and being invested in what's going on, at least with some of the key characters, such as the dad and the daughter. As far as monocles are concerned, this film, as we stated, does get a little heavy-handed in certain parts and doesn't quite, you know, hit and miss, hit a home run with other parts. So it's a little difficult to kind of, you know, begin to, I guess, scoring, because I wanted this one to really be great. I wanted it to really work out. Unfortunately, for this one, it didn't quite hit as well as The Invisible Man. but it still does well. So for my take, I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5 monocles. And, you know, it's a lot better than where we were. Let's just put it that way.
It could be a whole lot worse, too.
It could definitely
be Madam Web.
Oh, my God.
No, no one's that bad.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you could check us out over at our website at filmlosophers.podcast, filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense. If you're looking for it, head on over there, and we got it. Look for us there at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out over at the social pages. We're at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Filmosophy101. We're also on Blue Sky at Filmosophers Podcast there as well. We post all of our crazy hijink stuff over at Instagram, whether if it's Spencer's Big Score or Amy's Jane Unseen, which can be found
the only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. And if you're looking and going, hey, there looks to be like nothing here, I swear it's all up in our episodes, but guess what? You're in luck. New year, you haven't missed anything. You have an opportunity to go back.
Spencer, did we ever get that Steel Magnolias episode?
I don't remember.
Diabetes.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
You could also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a like, a subscribe, a follow, listen in, tell us how we're doing. Did you see the Wolfman or Wolfman? What did you think? How did it compare to the other previous iterations of the werewolf story? Did you like it? Do you think it could have been better? Let us know in the comment section. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
Of course, this was a great episode. This was a great conversation. And we hope to see you next time. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.